For the benefit of those who are already here and for the Secretary of Synod, who himself is a busy man. The Secretary of Synod is a man who, for the most part, works behind the scene. You do see him up at the podium at a convention of Synod. Unfortunately, however, many people in Synod do not know him by sight as they do many of the others. This morning, we have the distinct honor of meeting and hearing the Secretary of Synod, Dr. Herbert Miller. We will give him an opportunity to present whatever he has on his heart and mind for the first few moments, and then give you a chance to ask questions. He will speak to us on the significance of the Constitution and bylaws of Synod for us, and will probably refer to some of the rulings, and then give us an opportunity to ask our questions of him regarding either his role as Secretary of Synod or in relationship to the Commission on Constitutions or Constitutional Matters of our Synod. It takes me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Miller to you.
Thank you.
Well, you're very kind to give me applause. I usually don't get applause. I realize, of course, that our time is limited, and I don't want to impose on your schedule. I'm going to try to telescope this as much as possible. I'll dispense with jokes and funny stories, if you don't mind. I think that you are sophisticated enough by that time to be able to dispense with those things. I really had wanted to have the takeoff of my presentation. This article, which has now appeared in the latest issue of the Lutheran Witness, it carries the title, An Analysis of Assertions in Present Controversy. It's a document issued by the Commission on Constitutional Matters. How many of you have already seen that? Just a few of you, all right? Because this is basic to our presentation this morning. I'll just try very briefly to summarize this. You and I have been redeemed by the blood of Jesus Christ. You and I have been made children of God by faith in Jesus Christ. And we exalt in our freedom as children of God. We have been freed not only from the penalty of the law which Christ has borne for us, but we have also been freed from the demands of the law. This is one aspect of our liberation that is sometimes a little bit difficult for us to grasp. Now, as a result of that, we are inclined by God the Holy Spirit himself to dedicate our life to the glory of God and to the welfare of our neighbor. We sometimes refer to this as the doxological life. All right, we have been made children of God through the gospel. And now the question arises, well then, does the law of God still have any force for us in our life at all? Most Lutherans of the Missouri Synod of middle-aged stripe and older learned their truths from the Blue Catechism. And in the Blue Catechism, we have it spelled out very nicely for us that the law still has a threefold purpose. Out of the unconverted, and also
as a mirror to show us our sins
so that we can find our joy and salvation not in the law but in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then thirdly, and this is the point we're getting at, the law also serves as a guide to the Christian in his doxological life of praise to the God of all love as that life is lived out among men here on earth. So the law of God has a place also in the life of a Christian. We affirm the third purpose of the law. Now the next question arises, well, what about man-made laws? Do they have any place in the life of a Christian? Well, as soon as you have two people, including also Christian people, entering into any kind of relationship with each other, you have the necessity, the built-in necessity, let's call it that, of covenant, agreement, contract, or if you please, law. When you think of marriage, this is true. When you think of a business partnership, this is true. And it is true also of those units that we call Christian congregations. A Christian congregation is a worshiping and serving community of God in this world. People who have been brought to faith in Christ feel almost an inward compulsion to seek out others who share this divine sonship through adoption. And this is how Christian congregations come into existence. These are people who are gathered around Christ and around his word and around his sacraments. And they govern themselves, not only by the scriptures, and now let's throw in the Lutheran confessions, but they also govern themselves by sometimes unwritten traditions. In your own congregation back home, I'm sure you have unwritten traditions which are pretty well honored and observed by the members of your congregation. And then above all in relationship to unwritten traditions, by written covenants and agreements which are usually called congregational constitutions and bylaws. And that is true also of larger associations of congregations, such as agencies, councils, and synods. We make certain agreements with one another that this is what we want to do, this is why we want to do it, and this is how we're going to do it. That's spelled out for us in a constitution and in bylaws. So that is the function of also the constitution and the bylaws of the synod. These are to be looked upon as covenant agreements. And our synod, let's remind ourselves, is primarily an association or federation of congregations. It's true that individuals also join the synod, namely pastors and teachers who are qualified. Sometimes we like to refer to that as a professional membership in the synod to distinguish it from the basic membership which is held by the congregation. The franchise in the synod belongs not to any pastor, not to any teacher, but to the congregation. The congregation, in fact, has two votes. It has a pastoral vote and it has a lay vote. And it is the congregation which decides, if it happens to have two pastors, which pastor is to cast our pastoral vote and which lay person is to cast our lay vote. And this principle applies whether you're talking of district conventions or when you are putting congregations together in circuits for a synodical convention. Now, a congregation is self-governing. Now we want to speak of that in a relative way. Article 7 of our Constitution spells out the basic charter of the basic sovereignty of the local congregation. But this is to be thought of also in relative terms. A congregation which joins the synod does assume certain responsibilities which are listed especially in Article 6, which are the conditions of membership. Article 3, which speaks of the purposes or objectives of the synod, and Article 2, which speaks of the confessional basis of the synod. A congregation is not completely free to make up its own mind about, for instance, the confessional basis. It restricts its liberty. It does this willingly, it does this voluntarily. Nobody forces it to join the synod, but in order to receive the advantages and benefits of the synod, it is willing to do this. One of the principal concerns when our synod was organized was with respect to the training of pastors and teachers. It is significant to note that when our synod was organized, there were colleges and seminaries in our country as well as in Germany which were producing pastors for the Lutheran Church, but our forefathers decided they wanted to train their own pastors. Even before the synod was organized, as you know, the institution, the little log cabin institution, was established in Perry County. Now there is a responsibility of trust, mutual confidence when congregations join a synod. They make a solemn covenant with the other congregations in the synod that they will walk together. As far as their internal affairs are concerned, which have no bearing on their membership in the synod, they retain almost, well, I would say unrestricted autonomy. If the question is whether to paint the windows of the walls of their chapel green or blue, the synod is not even going to give any advice in this matter. But when these are matters which pertain to their requirements for membership and for the carrying out of the purposes for which they have joined the synod and the confessional base, then it becomes a slightly different matter. So we expect that Christian people also, when they are formed into congregations, and not only when we are dealing with them as individuals, are people of integrity who keep their word. And when they join an organization like the Synod and sign the Synod's constitution, we have a right to expect that they will live up to that covenant agreement. We have had a considerable amount of discussion in our day and age regarding the force of Article 7. Even the historical development of Article 7 is of interest, and you might want to have Dr. August Silklow tell you about that someday if you have not already heard him on that particular score. Let me use only one example to show you that there's more here than meets the eye. We have now in Article 7 the word inexpedient. In the original German constitution, the word was ungeeignet. Now, in our day and age, a lot of people have gotten to the point where they think of expedient as being almost equivalent to an expression, well, if we feel like it, then we will carry out this or that resolution of the synod, or this or that constitutional article of the synod. This is not what the fathers had in mind with ungeeignet. Ungeeignet really means it doesn't fit the circumstances. For instance, if the synod would pass, now let's not say pass a resolution even, let's make it more concrete and say an article of the Constitution. If there were an article in the Constitution regarding parochial schools, and here there's a congregation which does not have a parochial school, then that article of the Constitution is ungeeignet for that particular congregation. Now it's true, we have adopted the English Constitution with this new concept of inexpedient. This is true. But I think it's interesting if we indulge in a little historical criticism once in a while of our own Constitution and find out, well, what did they really want to say and what did they say originally? So this still has to be kept in mind, that there's a good deal of emphasis should be placed upon the sovereignty of the congregation, but a good deal of emphasis also needs to be placed upon the commitment which the congregation makes to walk together when it does join the synod. It no longer is completely unrestricted and free in its movements. Now that's perhaps a kind of a negative note on which to end. I have, as I indicated, telescoped this considerably because I really think that you are more interested perhaps in some questions that you have in your mind at the moment rather than hear me expound here. I do wish that this issue of the Lutheran Witness had come out earlier so that all of you had had an opportunity to read that article as a background for our discussion today. But do you have any questions that you would like to ask? There's one.
Yes, I'd like to know what interpretation of the bylaw where it says that, or maybe the Constitution says that all matters of doctrine or conscience will be decided only by the Word of God. All other matters will be decided by a majority vote. Therefore, and this is what follows, therefore, if something is voted upon by a majority vote, therefore it's not a matter of doctrine.
Well, that could take us for an hour. We had before the Commission on Constitutional Matters essentially that question raised in connection with the Denver resolution on fellowship with the ALC, where there were many people who were convinced that this was a doctrinal issue and therefore it should not be decided simply by a majority vote. But the Commission ruled that let's put it very simply, that if the scriptures had said something about having fellowship or not having fellowship with a church body called the American Lutheran Church, then it would have been an open and shut case. But that is not the situation. The doctrine has to be applied, and as Dr. Pieper so often said, the only purpose for which a vote on doctrinal matters is taken at a convention is to see whether all understand what the scriptures really teach on this particular point. The deeper question is one which, as you probably know, is still under very precise study. I don't know how much you people read or in this area, I mean the opinions issued by the Commission on Constitutional Matters, but the one larger opinion issued several months ago on the three disputed resolutions of the New Orleans Convention, the final recommendation of the CCM was to the effect that a special committee perhaps ought to be appointed to develop a separate bylaw regarding the procedure in which so-called doctrinal statements or resolutions should be adopted and how they may be amended and so forth. It's an area which needs further study on the part of our synod so that we avoid the traps of changing our mind every 2 years as to what we really teach corporately. That's the point I think we ought to keep in mind, the corporate position of the synod. The synod has a right certainly to state what its corporate position is. That's the one trap, and the other trap is that we simply say, well, we're paralyzed, we can't say anything about it. As long as somebody says, I'm willing to accept Article 2, You know, a lot of people say, sure, the Bible is the Word of God, and Lutheran confessions, oh, sure, I can accept them as historical oddities which reflect the life of the church at that particular time. This sort of thing. You see, these are the two extremes that we have to be on our guard against. And perhaps we need to more carefully define how we should handle questions of this type. Maybe in the next 2 years, some special committee would be at work on that.
I guess my question has to deal with 3-09. Exactly what status does that resolution have? What constitutional authority does a synodical convention have on passing this type of resolution?
Okay. I'm not trying to cop out on that question, but I would really suggest that the best thing for you to do would be to read this opinion that I just referred to, because you have to say quite a lot in answer to that question, and I think the Commission has met this question head on in that opinion. I can give you a Xerox copy if you can't lay your hands on it. Do you mind if we do it that way? It's not a cop out because we've spoken on it, but it does take you pretty far afield. Okay?
Well, one thing that's come under fire a lot these days is about the district presidents. You know, there's three right now who have a charge of dereliction of duty. What exactly is the role of district presidents, in this matter?
Well, to begin with, the procedural questions that are involved in these charges are still under study by the Commission on Constitutional Matters, which has been asked by several different sources to define precisely what the procedure should be. One of the sources is the Synod's own Commission of Adjudication. And therefore, there are no answers yet that I can give you at the moment about how to proceed when such charges are brought against a president, which would lead to his ultimate removal from office. However, having said that, there are other aspects of this larger problem which are quite clear. The one thing is this, that district presidents are not free to ordain whomever they wish. They are completely limited. Article 12 of the Constitution makes that very plain, that they are permitted to ordain or authorize the ecclesiastical ordination only of those candidates who have been assigned to congregations or other units in their district. Now here again, let's keep in mind in that connection what I said earlier, what the Synod really is. It's an association of congregations, primarily. And these congregations have said, this is the way we want our pastors to be trained, to be certified, to be placed, to be ordained, to be installed. And it's these congregations who give these instructions right in the Constitution, as far as the district president is concerned. And he has no choice. He must operate with the constitutional paragraph there. So if you would ask, is a district president constitutionally permitted to ordain someone who has not been assigned to his district, the answer is an obvious no. And I think that even those who did it admit this. Way back there?
Yeah, what's going to happen with the second year class this year for Vicarage next year?
You mean 801?
Seminex.
I have no answer for you because the Council of Presidents and I sat through three almost week-long meetings in which they wrestled first with the vicarage and then with the candidate problem. And the Council of Presidents itself said over and over and over again that what they were proposing was for this year only. And the expression that was used again and again was, this action is not to be regarded as precedent setting. Now, that was stated over and over again. And I know I don't want to identify people, but I know that one particular district president, who generally speaking has been quite open to the Seminex program, had to remind some of his fellow district presidents of that fact. Fellows, remember, we said this is not to be precedent setting. It's for this year only. So if anybody's guess as to what will happen this coming year. Last year's Seminex graduates, an effort was made to place them because it was felt that 801 faculty in all generosity would be willing to recognize the academic credits and somehow or other grant them the necessary diploma and so forth so that they could be placed. But this is a whole year later, and it would be pretty difficult to use the same rationale the next time around. And I think similar things could apply to the vicarage. I would sincerely hope and pray that some solution can be found. I don't think that most people, even on the 801 campus, are vindictive about this sort of thing. I think that everybody is trying their best to find a way in which some of these things can be done within the concepts of our Constitution and bylaws. Another question? We better go and take turns, right? Okay?
I appreciated your emphasis on the congregational policy of synod in response to the question about the district presidents. And I think it could be added yet that this was very helpful to me when I first began to realize that synod is not a federation, like the United States government is a federal organization of different states. But the district presidents are arms of the synodical president. And this is the complete opposite view. And district presidents used to be elected in a synodical convention, not by the districts. That is a more recent development, that they're elected by their own district. And therefore, the district president is supposed to be an assistant to the synodical president.
We have had an overture again in recent years to reinstitute this idea of having the synodical convention elect our district president. We have to stress again and again in the CCM, in our rulings and in our letters to people, what you say, that the Synod is not a federation of districts. The LCA is a federation of synods. They have an altogether different basic structure than we have. We are not a federation of districts. We are a synod, which then, at its own discretion, divides itself into administrative units, which we can call districts or other things, and it goes this way, and it doesn't go this way, really. Now, let's see. All right.
My question is, as far as the constitutional are being in the bylaws, where does the parallelism end between the ordination of the editor of Christian News and the present ordination which should take place?
I think that here we have to get into the Board of Appeals decision. Now, in the case of the I don't call him editor of Christian News, it's called pastor of the New Haven Congregation. Yeah, it's the New Haven Congregation. Well, he was declared not certified, or whatever you want to call it, by the St. Louis faculty at the time. The congregation, a small congregation of well-meaning Christians, many of them retired farmers, had been served by him in a sort of a vacancy relationship, I think, and learned to know him. And they were wondering whether they couldn't call him. There were people in the Synod, including also at least one man on the faculty of this institution, who advised the congregation, yes, you may do that. And they went ahead and called, and then the rest, of course, is history. When it finally came up to the Board of Appeals, it was, I think, generally agreed that the constitutional principle was very clear, that if a congregation wanted to remain a member of the Synod, it had to have a pastor who was recognized by the Synod. However, now I am summarizing the Board of Appeals on the basis of what has been published. What I read is that the Board of Appeals really came to the conclusion on the basis of equity, fairness, that this would be too big a penalty to inflict upon a little group of people who had acted in good faith, upon advice of people who are respected and so forth, you see. So this was an isolated case, and this is one reason why we have a Board of Appeals, so that finally the element of fairness gets into it too, and not only the law, the covenants, the Constitution and the bylaws. But the principle is clear, and it was spelled out again in by the Denver Convention, in respect to two overtures, and neither one of the two overtures had anything to do with the New Haven case. Now, that's the folklore that's gotten around. There are two overtures that were submitted to the Denver Convention. One was based on the proposed fellowship of the American Lutheran Church, and the other one was based upon a situation in a congregation other than New Haven, which was, both of these were really fundamentally raising the question, does a congregation really have to have as pastor
a pastoral member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And the Denver Convention said, of course, we've operated this way from the very beginning, from Walther's time. There's been an unbroken tradition on this thing. But the Denver Convention said, in order to make it real clear to people, we will even adopt a bylaw, which today is known as bylaw 4.01, A and B, both in the handbook. And I think that one of the most informative things that you people can do, if you are concerned about the relationship of congregations to the synod, is to look up that that resolution of the Denver Convention. If you want to take it down, it's the 1969 proceedings, and it's resolution 5-23. It covers a whole page. I'm tempted to read it to you, because it's a long preamble which sets forth very clearly this philosophical point, and then it leads finally into the resolve to adopt this bylaw 4.01. And incidentally, that floor committee was not a bunch of dummies. I sat with that floor committee, and I learned to respect its judgment. And incidentally, it might interest you to know that the chairman of that floor committee was President Meadner of the Nebraska District, and the secretary of that floor committee, all of you, I think, know, that was Professor Volz from Concordia Seminary here, who is not with Seminex now any longer, but I think he's with Bethany or
Luther.
Luther. Well, I think that most of you know him. So you see, it's a principle that has been accepted in our synod throughout. Okay? Any other question?
I don't imagine that the CCM is going to have the rule on it, but I'm curious as to maybe your opinion on the fact that John Keegan, according to the bylaw, did not have a hearing in the sense that he did not at 6.79J or something, did not sit face to face with the board.
Well, here again, I could comment on it, but I believe that in fairness to Dr. Teachin and the 90-day period, maybe I should not comment on it. If you ask me after the 90-day period, I'll give you my opinion on it.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
How many members of CCM have been on that body before 1969?
Good question. We took pains because of the fact that the CCM had been referred to as a pocket committee by one of the Concordia faculty members, and a few other critical comments had been made. We took pains in our report to the last convention to give a pedigree of the membership of the commission. And I think it's extremely interesting. It has two pastors, two laymen, and then the secretary of the synod. The one pastor had been appointed by Dr. Harms. When his term was up, Dr. Price reappointed him. The second pastor had been appointed by Dr. Harms. When his term was up, Dr. Price reappointed him. And then when his second term was up, it came under the limited tenure rule, and he could not be reappointed again. So Dr. Price at that time had to appoint a new pastoral member, you see. So that was one of his appointees, let's say. The two laymen, both of them lawyers, the one lawyer had been appointed, I always kiddingly said he'd been appointed by Noah. Because it was Dr. Herb Kinney who traced his pedigree way back. Perhaps the best constitutionalist our Senate has ever had or ever will have, a lawyer from Baltimore, who, because he devoted most of his time to the Senate, never made much money as a lawyer. But he was appointed by Dinkin and reappointed by Harms. That was before the limited tenure rule was adopted. And then he was reappointed also by Dr. Price. And then he died. So, of course, Dr. Price had to appoint a successor then, as we don't have dead men serving on commission. Then the other lawyer was a man who had been appointed by Dr. Harms. And his term, when it expired, Dr. Price reappointed him. This was a lawyer from Chicago, English district lawyer. And Dr. Price reappointed him, but the man declined to accept reappointment. So again, Dr. Price had to supply a replacement for him. And then the fifth member of the commission, that's yours truly. Now, I was, and I'm elected to that position. I'm not appointed to the commission, but by virtue of my office, I am ex officio a member of the Commission on Constitutional Matters. And I was elected Secretary of the Senate at the Detroit Convention, which was long before anybody really had ever heard of Dr. Price as potentially a president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So for one full four-year term, I was serving with Dr. Harms. So, I mean, I think this needs to be said, because you can believe me or you don't have to believe me, but I do want to state publicly, as I have stated again and again, that I have found all of the men who during my tenure have served on the Commission on Constitutional Matters to be men of integrity. They are not motivated and never have been, as far as I was ever able to detect, by any political considerations. In fact, this is one of the groups which is kept as free of administration, control, or even information as is possible. I don't know whether you're familiar with that or not. But there is a division of church government, and I happen to be the chairman of that division. And I have fought for this. This is way back in the days of Dr. Harms and Dr. Walbrecht, that the groups within that division should be completely independent, so that not even minutes from those groups go to the president's office. The minutes of all of the boards and commissions in the Synod are expected to go to the president's office as part of his administrative responsibility, you see. But in that division of church government, you have the Council of Presidents, you have the Board of Appeals, you have the Synodical Commission of Adjudication, you have the Commission on Constitutional Matters, you have the Board of Doctrinal Review, and you have the Committee for Convention Nominations. And they are completely divorced from the office of the president. And they should be. They are directly responsible to the Synod and Convention. I hope you'll remember that, because we try to be very honorable about these things. Any other questions? Dr. Spitz?
May I make a remark that I find that comes up again and again? I kind of sensed it in the question that a brother asked here before. Referring to the so-called Christ statement, the question is always asked, why does this statement not have to be passed by a unanimous vote, right? Because doctrinal matters should be passed by a unanimous vote. I think that question does not go back far enough. The question must be put at this point where a new theology rises in our church. And it is now recognized that we have two theologies in our church. The old Missouri Synod theology and something new that has come into our church. Now the question should be asked, what right did any man in the Missouri Synod have to introduce a new theology into our church without a unanimous vote? And this so-called Christ statement is not introducing a new theology. It is simply a protest against a new theology that has been introduced into our church without a unanimous vote.
I think you had another hand here. Did you? You had your hand up, all right.
Going back to the matter you mentioned before about expediency, in whose responsibility is it finally to decide what would be expedient for a given congregation?
Well, if there's any question about it, I suppose the Commission on Constitutional Matters would be asked. Does this particular thing fall under our constitutional commitments? Now, let me take the bull by the horns. Let me refer specifically to the calling of uncertified pastors. Does this fall under the Constitution? It certainly does. Article 6, requirements for membership. One of the requirements is the regular call of pastors. Now, you guys are Latin sharks. You know what regular comes from. The regula, the rules. And these are not the rules laid down in the scriptures merely that are referred to here. And here again, apply a little textual criticism this time to it, because that statement of the Constitution goes on to say that requirement of membership is the regular call of pastors and the regular election of lay delegates. Where do you have that in the scriptures, you see? There's no reference to that. So the regular, in both instances, on the same plane, they have to refer to the regula of the synod. The rules that the Synod establishes. So, question, can the Synod tell us to paint our walls green? No. Synod may be advisory. Synod may come along and say, why do you want to use this expensive paint here in this mission congregation that we're subsidizing? There's a lot cheaper paint available that you could use, you see. It could be advisory. But may Synod step in when a congregation which still wants to retain its membership calls somebody who is ineligible for the ministry in that congregation? Then he answers, yes, because that's the condition of membership, spelled out in the Constitution. Okay? Oh, let's see, I think that Dr. Wunderlich had his hand up before. I'm sorry.
Well, I think perhaps the Reverend would like to know, since the Board of Appeals was mentioned,
that the autonomy and the completely divorced from synodical administration position of the Board of Appeals is safeguarded by the fact that members of the Board of Appeals are elected on the floor of the convention. They're not appointed by anyone in Synod.
That's a very good point.
Mrs.
Is it possible for a synodical convention to reverse itself?
Yes. Yes.
To be very specific, if at the next convention they decide that 309 was all wrong, can the former faculty come back here? Try a synodical resolution.
Well, theoretically, it could do this, but there would certainly be a lot of practical problems involved and a lot of other things that have to be looked at. But the CCM, in this larger ruling on the three disputed resolutions of New Orleans, also stated that a synod has the right to change its mind like any grand old lady has. that's the kind of in-joke. People who know me know I always refer to the synod as a grand old lady, and she's very much in trouble at the present time. She needs a little help to get across the street, so I hope we all give her a little help. But Mrs. I don't know whether I answered. Well, the Board of Control, this gets us into the whole area of the accountability of all boards to the conventions of the Synod. Now, every action of a board is reviewable by the convention. See, this is a point that is often raised in the other direction. We hear it again and again. What year are we in now? 74? 73? The 1971 convention approved, in one way or another, a report of the Board of Control which cleared the props. And then now, how can the 1973 convention turn this over again? Well, it can be done. But this is one reason why we do think that there should be a more precise set of procedures involved, especially when it comes to doctrinal resolutions and statements, so that these things can perhaps go through a period of study, refinement, and so forth before they are finally adopted. But what the formula is, nobody has really been able to come up with that answer yet.
Just in response to what you had said, another thought, the 1971 convention cleared the statute.
Well, that's the argument that's always used.
That but at that time, they hadn't even the report of the investigative committee had not been made known.
No, but the point is that there was a report from the Board of Control to the convention, and you see, the Board of Control had been told to take care of it. And the Board of Control reported to the convention and said, we have taken care of it, and we have found them not guilty, you see. This is really what I meant. I was using shorthand there. But that's the argument now that we hear. But even if this were the case, and we state that in this opinion, that a convention of the Synod certainly does have the right to change its mind. It has done so on more than one occasion. But we don't think it's wise to be changing one's mind in regard to doctrinal issues. And that's why we think we need to be very careful how these things are decided.
Can I add this other thought to the question you asked about the past of the Newgate congregation? I think precisely there the Synod does handle that slightly, but he is not a pastor in the Synod.
That he's not recognized.
He's not recognized, and because he has not fulfilled the requirements of the Constitution of the Synod. And I think the situation also should be pointed out that at that time the congregation called him, some of the existing bylaws were not in the handbook, such as the one that you mentioned, so that it could be impossible to apply this to him ex post facto, having once done that. And then the Board of Appeals did rule, or it was a 5-5 vote on a show cause case, where this faculty here had to show cause why he wasn't to be certified. And a 5-5 decision is a hung jury, and it was all this information that the congregation took in mind, and they had this before when they called him, which makes it a completely different situation. So I think
The thing that I wanted to point out, I believe, was this, that even though the Missouri District, for instance, had said that the congregation was to forfeit its membership as a result of that, the Board of Appeals really said that's too harsh. Now, I'm trying to put it into simple language, but this is where we read the Board of Appeals to come out. And it was a question then, in my estimation, of equity. But you are right. To this day, the pastor of New Haven is not listed on the roster of the Synod. However, this is the one instance where the congregation still retains its membership. Okay? Because of the Board of Appeals decision.
I just want to say that was basically my question. Where did the parallelism end? And I think that answers.
Okay, good. Back there, Professor Keel?
Yes. Going back to the matter of border controls in court in the New Orleans Convention 71, the statement that the board had cleared the situation, how do you comment on that in light of Resolution 309 and what's the other resolution in connection with how to teach?
Well, we have consistently replied that, after all, a convention received the report subsequently and adopted a certain resolution, and even if that is in conflict with an action, an earlier action of the Board of Control, the resolutions of the Synod prevail. The constitutional principle there is that all officers, boards, and commissions are accountable for all their decisions to the convention. The convention can say yes and amen to a decision of a board, and it can also say uh-uh to a decision of a board. Let's see, this man hadn't asked yet, shall we give him the chance?
Yeah.
Listen, fellas, it's 10 minutes to 12. I'm ready to cut off any time you get hungry.
I want to answer these next two questions.
Those next two? All right.
Just perhaps a point of clarification. Wasn't it true that at the Milwaukee Convention, what the Milwaukee Convention in 71 did was receive a Board of Control report upon which they had declared that they had as yet received any compelling evidence that any faculty member was guilty of false doctrine, and that they did not formally exonerate them vis-a-vis the fact-finding investigation until early 1973,
yeah.
Early 1973, to which then the New Orleans conventions then reversed that.
That's right. But there was a reversal of one board's action by the next board, which had been elected by the Synod. So you see, it's this is part of the rules of the game. This is the way we do it in order to avoid an autocracy. The Senate finally, through the elective process, if in no other way, makes itself heard. Over here?
Just follow up on that. How about the concept of double jeopardy? How does that fit into our constitutional system?
That's one for the lawyers. Now, we have often talked about that, but I don't think that double jeopardy can really come into play when you're dealing with brethren within the church which have agreed to certain rules and procedures. And the double jeopardy is built in to our system whereby we say that every action of a board is reversible by a convention. Because there you got double jeopardy right away then, don't you? But we have agreed in advance to these rules of the game. So that's what we live with. And we have the reverse is true, too, that no one can be condemned on only one level. But there's always at least two levels, the whole appeals business, and there are several different routes of appeal. And this is good, so that there's always a second court.
I know, well, I learned tremendously.
Well, I want to say I've enjoyed being here. I like to talk constitutional matters with people who are interested, but a few years ago, nobody was ever interested in that.